I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's September 12th, and we have a lot to talk about. Just a couple of weeks ago, in episode number 313 of the podcast, we talked about the FDA's approval of the first biosimilar medication for treating MS. This is, without question, a positive step forward in making disease-modifying therapies more affordable. But I know some of you have questions. Some of you have told me that you've already been surprised to find that your pharmacist has substituted a generic in place of the brand name medication that both you and your neurologist may have believed you were going to receive, which in most every case isn't a bad thing, but it can cause some confusion. So as generics and now biosimilars become more available, it seemed like the right time for us to get clear on the similarities and differences between generics, biosimilars, and the name brand drugs they mimic. Joining me to explain everything you need to know to be an informed medical consumer when it comes to generic and biosimilar disease-modifying therapies is Dr. Jiwon Oh. Dr. Oh is a neurologist, scientist, and the medical director of the Barlow Multiple Sclerosis Program at St. Michael's Hospital in Ontario, Canada. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Oh, there are a few other things that you should know about. Over the past several months, we've talked about the value and importance of thinking about MS, describing MS, and treating MS in terms of the biological mechanisms that are taking place in an individual, rather than strictly relying on clinical symptoms. This was driven home to me last week when I heard from a friend who's living with MS. Her symptoms are and have been stable for the past couple of years. She and her neurologist both felt her disease-modifying therapy was doing its job. Then she had her annual MRI exam just a couple of weeks ago. And that exam showed that two of her existing lesions had grown substantially, and there was a new lesion as well. As you might expect, my friend was shocked at realizing she had experienced what she describes as subclinical progression. In other words, her MS had progressed, but she hadn't yet experienced any worsening of her symptoms or any new symptoms. Now, she and her neurologist have decided to change her DMT, and she's hoping that she won't be experiencing any symptom worsening in the near future. But honestly, that hope seems more like fear. And that's just not a good way to wake up every day, wondering if that will be the day when you meet your new or worsened MS symptoms. Now, I'll also add, my friend has more resilience than almost anyone I've met, so I know she'll come through this latest twisty turn in her MS journey smiling. But wouldn't it be so much better if she hadn't been ambushed with this kind of news at all? Well, we may be closer to that day than ever before. Octave Bioscience has developed a blood test that measures the levels of 18 different proteins in the blood, and using artificial intelligence algorithms, predicts the risk of new disease activity in people living with MS. Now, it's clear that MS disease activity and progression can vary widely from one individual to the next. And researchers have demonstrated that disease progression may be a bit more universal and may exist on a broader timeline than had been previously assumed. And while MRI scans can help track disease activity, these exams are expensive, and they typically occur annually and sometimes at even longer intervals. Being able to detect disease activity from a simple blood test changes everything when it comes to routinely measuring MS disease activity. Octave's MS disease activity test, or MSDA test, measures 18 proteins in the blood. Now, these proteins were identified based on analyzing more than 1,000 proteins in blood samples from thousands of patients. Based on these protein levels, AI algorithms calculate an overall disease activity score that reflects four different disease processes: immune activity, inflammation in the nervous system, myelin biology, and nerve fiber damage. Now, the study that validated the MSDA test included data from 614 people living with MS. 426 blood samples were used to train the algorithms that interpret the MSDA test results, and 188 samples were used to evaluate its accuracy. The researchers evaluated the MSDA test using a statistical measure called an ORAC, a benchmark between two groups, in this case, MS patients with or without disease activity. The benchmark values range from 0.5 to 1, with a higher number indicating more accurate performance. The MSDA test had an ORAC of 0.781 for identifying inflamed lesions, a score of 0.75 for identifying new or enlarging lesions, and a score of 0.768 for identifying overall disease activity. People with moderate to high MSDA scores were more than four times more likely to have at least one inflamed lesion compared to people with low MSDA scores. And people with a high MSDA score were more than 20 times as likely to have two or more inflamed lesions. The validation study was funded by Octave Bioscience and the U.S. Department of Defense as part of the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program for MS. And it certainly makes the case that a minimally invasive blood test that accurately correlates with new MS lesions can only lead to improved, affordable, and more regular monitoring of disease activity in the clinic. Now, the research team in this validation test did indicate that further validation is still needed, particularly in more diverse populations, as most of the patients in this validation study were white. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. A moment ago, when we were talking about the funding for the study used to validate Octave's MS disease activity test, I mentioned that the study was partially funded by the U.S. Department of Defense, and that may have surprised some of you. There are more than 70,000 U.S. veterans living with MS, so Congress has established funding through the Department of Defense for high-risk, high-reward MS research. It's actually the only federal funding that's specifically earmarked for MS research. Moving from the laboratory bench to the bedside, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs operates MS Centers of Excellence that provide MS treatment to our veterans. And like any large federal program, navigating through this system can sometimes be challenging. The Paralyzed Veterans of America, or PVA, is the only veteran service organization with service officers who specialize in helping honorably discharged veterans living with MS, as well as ALS and spinal cord injuries, with their claims. Recently, I had a conversation with Izzy Abbas, the co-chairperson of the Paralyzed Veterans of America's MS Committee, and we talked about how the PVA supports veterans who are living with MS. In a moment, you'll meet Izzy Abbas and hear our conversation. Today, there are over 70,000 U.S. military veterans living with MS. That's why the only federal funding that's earmarked specifically for MS research comes from the U.S. Department of Defense. And the Paralyzed Veterans of America, or PVA, is the only veteran service organization with service officers who specialize in MS, as well as ALS and spinal cord injury. Joining me today to talk about how the PVA supports our veterans is the co-chair of the Paralyzed Veterans of America's MS Committee, Izzy Abbas. Welcome to the podcast, Izzy.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here and look forward to sharing information about, just the issues facing veterans with MS.
Well, some of our listeners may not be familiar with the PVA, so can you tell us what the Paralyzed Veterans of America is all about?
Sure. Paralyzed Veterans of America actually only started in 1946. And I say only is because if you look at some of the other big veteran service organizations like the VFW, the DAV, and the American Legion. They all go back, you know, some more than 100 years. And actually, there was a officer within the VFW who asked the former president of PVA, hey, why is PVA only, why has it only been around since 1946? And our president responded, well, that's because life expectancy of somebody with a spinal cord injury was probably measured in weeks, maybe months, but prior to, you know, antibiotics being available. So PVA has, it's one service organization that does, you're absolutely right, it does specialize in helping veterans with their claims with the VA for spinal cord injuries, but also MS and ALS. And MS, it's interesting. We have an interesting history with MS because our first president, national president for PVA, Guilford Moss, had MS. And this was back in 1946.
So tell me, I think you've already started to. What are some of the ways that the PVA supports U.S. veterans who are living with MS?
Sure. Well, first of all, I just want to say there's no cost to join PVA. When you talk to the organization, we feel that all of us veterans who qualify for membership in PVA have already done enough, given enough to actually be part of the organization. You know, unfortunately, it's like, you know, you wish people didn't qualify to join PVA, but if they are, there's a home for them with us. And what PVA does is their biggest focus, I would say, is to ensure that no veteran's isolated, and especially if they're dealing with severe injuries that result in spinal cord injuries, or they have MS or ALS. You know, the big thing is to make sure they're not isolated. You know, that's why they're a big partner with the Department of Veterans Affairs for the National Wheelchair Games. That's why they have the Winter Sports Clinic. They don't care what you do. They just want you outside doing something and away from just sitting in front of the TV, being isolated. And so that's our big focus. Overall, PVA, I would say, is they've got, they're very big on advocacy. In fact, a big effort behind the Americans with Disability Act was through grassroots efforts of PVA. They're also in the forefront of pushing for execution and expansion of the American Air Carrier Act so that it, you know, it's interesting because PVA does all this for veterans, but the entire disability community benefits for all the efforts that they put into things. PVA also has their own architecture department, and they work with all the federal buildings around the country to ensure that they're ADA compliant. And so those are some of the things that we do as an organization.
So I understand that 1 in 4 of your members is living with MS, and the PVA has established a national MS committee. Can you tell me a little bit about the committee's work?
At one point there was, you know, you had to show spinal cord involvement with MS. And, you know, from my lay perspective, I always assumed that the brain was just one end of the spinal column. And actually, you know, there was a, you know, you had a lot of veterans who had MS, but they only had lesions in their brain. Back 2 years ago, I asked Dr. Michelle Cameron, who's the chief of the VA's MS Center of Excellence West, and I asked her, what percentage of veterans have it in their brain and it eventually shows up in their spine? And she said, officially 82%. But we think that number is 100%. It's just that the MRIs don't always pick up the small lesions. That actually expanded. So now all veterans who are honorably discharged veterans who are diagnosed with MS are eligible to become members of PVA. And part of that is once we got that passed, we set up an MS committee. We have Air Force, Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine veterans who all have MS. And what we do is we have 33 chapters around the country. We have one representative from each chapter, and they share information with their chapter and their veterans who have MS on some of the resources and new things that are coming out. And so really, it's kind of the biggest purpose of the committee is to stimulate discussion and information flowing both up from the chapters and down from national, what's going on at the national level.
So I guess this is the important question. How can some of the veterans who may be listening to our conversation today, how can they connect with the PVA?
Easiest way to do it is to go to pva.org. That's paralyzedveteransofamerica.org. And there are links on there to connect with a chapter or the national office, and they'll help you find those resources, and they'll find a resource close to where you live. If you have any problems with that, you can always email mscommittee@pva.org, and somebody will get back to you and help you with things. And one thing I did want to point out is we have a lot of people who are coming. They're still active duty when they're diagnosed with MS. They don't realize some of the tools and some of the assistance that's available out there. So one of our big efforts is also outreach with people who are, you know, coming off of what we call terminal leave or they're transitioning out of the military. They're like, look, if you find yourself in this unenviable position, there are resources. We can help you. We can help you with your VA claims. We can help you with different things that are going to help you as you deal with this life-changing disease.
Well, I'm going to be sure to add pva.org to today's show notes, so it'll be easy for people to find and click and visit the site. Izzy Abbas, first, thank you for your service. Thank you for all you and the PVA continue to do to improve the lives of our veterans who are living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
John, it was a real pleasure. And I just have to say, I found your podcast. I was diagnosed in 2017, and I think it was probably that year after I found your podcast, and it's been very helpful for me. So happy to be part of it and honored to be here with you, sir.
I'd like to give you a final reminder that if you're going to be in New York City on September 18th and you're ready to laugh for a good cause, I hope you check out the Stand Up to MS Comedy Club benefit at the Gotham Comedy Club. The show's going to feature 5 comics, an open bar, and a silent auction, with all of the proceeds going to support an ongoing research project at the Weill Cornell Medical College in collaboration with Rockefeller University. If you're a regular listener, you're already familiar with the research being funded through this event. It's the work being led by Dr. Tim Vartanian. And if you'd like to learn more about Dr. Vartanian's current research on the possible cause of MS, you can check out episode number 292 of Real Talk MS. The Stand Up to MS Comedy Club benefit takes place September 18th at the Gotham Comedy Club on West 23rd Street in New York. If you're interested in learning more, buying a ticket, or making a donation, you'll find that link in today's show notes. As we're heading into flu season, I think it's worth mentioning that newly published results from a large national study in France show that there is no connection between getting vaccinated and having an MS relapse. This proved to be true for common vaccines, including the combination diphtheria vaccine, tetanus, polio, whooping cough, the pneumococcal vaccine, and the flu vaccine. This evidence supports the American Academy of Neurology guidelines that recommend routine vaccinations for people with MS. The study itself utilized the System of Health National Database Registry, which includes the health records for 65 million people. That's more than 99% of the French population. The research team identified 106,523 people who had been diagnosed with MS and followed them for an average of 8.8 years, analyzing a 60-day window following any routine vaccination. Now, this latest evidence speaks directly to what we still see as an ongoing debate on social media about whether being vaccinated causes an MS relapse. Hopefully, The data generated by analyzing more than 100,000 people with MS will carry a bit more weight than the anonymous social media post by someone who has, quote unquote, done their own research. If you'd like to review the details of this study, or if you'd like to review the vaccination guidelines that have been established by the American Academy of Neurology for people living with MS, or if you'd like to review the detailed information the National MS Society has compiled about the effects of specific vaccinations on people with MS, you'll find those links in today's show notes. As you can probably tell, I'm a big believer that reliable information from trusted sources is real power. It allows you to be a full participant along with your neurologist or MS specialist in planning and managing your own treatment. Besides having a basic understanding of the brand name disease-modifying therapies that you and your neurologist might want to consider, there are more affordable generics and now biosimilar drugs that you also want to be aware of. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Jiwon Oh, who's joining us to help us better understand the similarities and the differences between generics, biosimilars, and the brand name drugs they're manufactured to mimic. We know that disease-modifying therapies, or DMTs, can reduce the number of MS relapses, delay the progression of disability, and limit new disease activity as seen on an MRI scan. We also know that these medications can be incredibly expensive. But now, more affordable options are becoming available in the form of biosimilar and generic medications. Joining me to help us better understand what biosimilars and generics are, the differences between them, and their role in treating MS is Dr. Jiwon Oh. Dr. Oh is a neurologist, scientist, and the medical director of the Barlow Multiple Sclerosis Program at St. Michael's Hospital in Ontario, as well as an associate professor at the University of Toronto. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Oh.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Most of us have probably heard the term generic drugs before. Some of us may already be using generics. So I'm hoping you can explain the similarities and differences between a generic and a brand name medication. And I hope you'll share some examples of brand name disease-modifying therapies that have a generic available.
Sure. Many of the drugs that we use to treat people living with MS, as well as in other disease states, consist of pretty simple chemical compounds that have to go through a very rigorous process of drug development, including phase one and then phase two clinical trials, and then phase three clinical trials, which definitively show that a drug is efficacious and safe to use in a disease state. And obviously, we're talking about MS today. And so when a drug goes through that process, and simple chemical compound drugs, which are what most of our MS therapies are, but not all of them, a pharmaceutical company then has an exclusive patent on that drug for a number of years, depending on what part of the world you're in. And so when that exclusive patent runs out, other companies are able to manufacture these chemical compounds with the same active chemical substance, but there are some slight differences in comparison to the brand name drug, usually with the inactive substances that constitute a drug. And so this is essentially what a generic molecule is. It's a simple chemical compound where the active chemical substance is identical to the brand name drug, but there may be some slight differences with some of the inactive chemical substances. But the bottom line is the generic drug has to show in very clear clinical trials that from a clinical standpoint, with respect to efficacy and safety, it's nearly identical to the brand name parent drug. And so in terms of examples, John, we actually have seen in the very recent past a number of generic molecules emerge on the MS treatment scene. And so probably the first generic molecule that emerged was generic fingolimod. So Gilenya is probably a drug that's very familiar to many of our listeners. It was the first widely used oral therapy for people with relapsing MS. And in the last number of years, there have been a number of generic versions of Gilenya that have emerged. So this is generic fingolimod, which is the active substance. And then in the more recent past, there also have been generic forms of Aubagio that have emerged. And so that active chemical compound in that setting is teriflunomide.
Another term that we've recently started talking about in the MS community is biosimilar. And I'm guessing that some of our listeners may not be as familiar with that term. So can you explain the similarities and differences between a biologic and biosimilar medication? And once again, I hope you can share an example of a biologic that has a biosimilar available for treating MS.
Sure. You know, very similar, analogous, I should say, to the discussion that we just had about brand name chemical compounds and generic compounds. When it comes to biological molecules, so some of our MS therapies fall into this category, and biological compounds are very different from simple chemical substances because they include organic or living substances. And so obviously the manufacturing process is very different and they're just much more complicated. But examples of biologic molecules that we use for treatment in MS include the monoclonal antibodies. So Tysabri, for instance, Ocrevus, for instance, these are all examples of biologic molecules. And so analogous to the discussion that we had with brand name and generic molecules, in the biologic world, when there's a reference product, like say Tysabri, if a molecule goes through a very rigorous regulatory process showing that it's nearly identical to the reference product, so this is the biologic equivalent of a generic, essentially. So it's not called a generic, though, it's called a biosimilar. So in a nutshell, you know, similar to what we talked about with brand name molecules as well as the generic, in the biological compound world, the reference molecule, a biosimilar is essentially the generic version of the reference molecule, which is a complicated biologic product. An example in the MS world of a very recently approved by the FDA biosimilar medication is Tyruko. And this is a biosimilar of the reference product Tysabri, which is a disease-modifying treatment that I think many of our listeners are familiar with.
Not only are biosimilar and generic medications made differently, but in the United States, they're also approved and regulated differently. Can you talk a bit about those approval processes?
Sure. So it's actually a completely different regulatory process when it comes to biologic compounds in comparison to simple chemical compounds. So I think it's probably safe to say that both, regardless of whether it's a simple chemical compound and a generic product that is similar to the parent compound or a biosimilar that's similar to the reference product, it's a very rigorous process in general, but there's actually different divisions of regulatory bodies that oversee the approval process. And this is because, and we'll probably touch on this theme many times, when it comes to biologic molecules, it's just always that much more complicated. And this has to do with the fact that they're just not simple chemical compounds that are generated in a lab. They include living organic substances. And because of this, they're much more complex compounds and then go through a very distinct regulatory process before they're approved as biosimilars to a reference product.
Why might someone living with MS switch from their brand name medication to a biosimilar or generic medication?
So, you know, there's always many different reasons, but I would say the most common reason, John, it has to do with cost. And this is because, you know, when an exclusive patent runs out and a generic or a biosimilar becomes available, there's always cost savings with the manufacturer because there's not the immense amount of dollars that need to be poured into the entire drug development process. And so because these molecules can be generated at usually a cheaper cost, when they are on the market, they are typically a substantial proportion cheaper than the parent compound. So generics are usually a proportion cheaper than the brand name molecule. And then with the biosimilars as well, they tend to be a significant proportion cheaper than the reference product. And so often, depending on what sort of reimbursement plan an individual living with MS has, and again, this varies substantially, there often is a time when, say, a generic emerges or a biosimilar emerges that people who are on the brand name product are strongly encouraged or sometimes even mandated to switch to the generic molecule or the biosimilar. And so, you know, and then there are some differences, as we've talked about, with generic molecules and the parent compound in terms of inactive chemical substances. So sometimes if someone, you know, responds well to a medication in terms of efficacy and general safety, but may have some tolerability issues, in some settings, there may be a switch related to some question of tolerability. But in most cases, it really has to do with cost.
You mentioned biosimilars are made from living sources, and that can result in natural variations between batches. Are those inconsistencies from one batch to another something that people should be concerned about?
So I think one thing to note is that when it comes to biological compounds, everything, again, is just much more complicated. And so variability is not an exception. It's the rule. And, you know, even within different batches of, say, Tysabri, one would entirely expect there to be a certain degree of variation. However, the amount of variation that one expects just simply related to biologic variability is pretty limited. And so it's important to note that while a small amount of variation is to be expected, anytime the variability exceeds beyond the threshold of what is expected because of simple biologic variability, this is when it's a red flag. And so when it comes to the differences between a reference product that's a biologic and a biosimilar, there is variability to be expected, but this is pretty strictly controlled within certain margins.
While a biosimilar to treat MS was just recently approved, biosimilars themselves aren't brand new. How long have biosimilars been around, and what other health conditions are being managed by biosimilars?
So, you know, most people are probably familiar with the concept of generics, as you already mentioned, John. And with biosimilars in the MS world, it's a new concept just because very excitingly in the last week, in fact, the FDA approved the first biosimilar in MS, which is Tyruko. That's a biosimilar to the reference product Tysabri, which many of you are familiar with. But this actually isn't a new concept when thinking about the wider clinical world, because biosimilars have been around since 2015, which sounds kind of recent, but it's actually almost a decade ago. And so there are over 40 different biosimilars that have been approved for use around the world. And there's another molecule that many people with MS might be familiar with, rituximab, which is a drug that's actually very similar to Ocrevus, which is a very commonly used, widely approved MS medication. But rituximab is kind of the older cousin of Ocrevus. And actually, while it's not widely approved for use in MS, it is very commonly used in many different parts of the world living with MS. And so rituximab is an example of a drug that there are many different biosimilars of rituximab that are pretty widely used. And the biosimilars of rituximab have been used to treat not just MS, but many other neuroinflammatory and systemic inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, which are also pretty common diseases that many people have heard of. But there's many different indications that different biosimilars have been used for, you know, again, for nearly a decade.
I've heard stories that someone living with MS and using a brand name disease modifying therapy, they go to the pharmacy to pick up a prescription refill and they find that they've been switched to a generic without their consent or even their awareness. So what can you tell us about automatic generic substitution?
So, you know, again, because generics are simple chemical compounds, they're, a drug that the chemically active substance is really identical to the parent drug or brand name drug in many parts of the world. And actually, the rules around this differs quite a bit, even depending on what state you live in. But in many parts of the world, including in Canada, pharmacists actually have the authority to automatically substitute a generic product for the brand name product because it's thought that these substances are so chemically similar.
You know, in our conversation today, and I think the way most people typically think, we think of a biosimilar as a replacement for a biologic. But I'm wondering whether a biologic can be substituted for a biosimilar medication. So maybe you can talk a bit about interchangeability.
You know, as we talked about earlier, although we draw the analogy between brand name chemical compounds and the generic, as well as the reference product biologic and the biosimilar, when it comes to biologic products, a general rule of thumb is that everything is much more complicated. And that applies to, you know, what we've talked about with the manufacturing process, the regulatory process, everything. And so actually a big distinction between, again, that analogy between generics and biosimilars is that pharmacists typically cannot substitute a reference product for a biosimilar unless the biosimilar has received this very coveted and actually quite rare designation of being interchangeable. So just as an illustration, even though there's 40 different biosimilars that have been approved for various indications around the world, only three of them have received this coveted interchangeable designation, meaning that it can be thought of as interchangeable with a reference product. And in that setting, pharmacists can automatically substitute the reference product. So in the MS world, that would be Tysabri for the biosimilar Tyruko. But this is only if the biosimilar has received pretty difficult to achieve designation of being interchangeable, which obviously requires quite a bit of data to support it.
Dr. Jiwano, I want to thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me, John. It's always a pleasure.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/315. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.